This morning, I'd like to take the time I have to go through a well-known story. I did this about 2 years ago with the account of Sodom and Gomorrah. During that, we learned that Sodom and Gomorrah weren't the only cities that were destroyed that day. We learned through Deuteronomy 29, verse 23, that there were two other cities destroyed, Admah and Zeboim. We also learned that more was supposed to be done that day. In Genesis 19 and verse 21, it says, "And he said to him," he being the angel speaking to Lot, "See, I have favored you, and concerning this thing also, and that I will not overthrow this city which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." There the name of the city was called Zoar. Two angels were supposed to destroy a fifth city that day, Zoar. Those five cities were known as the cities of the plains. They were all located in and around the Dead Sea area, about 15 to 18 miles apart from each other. They know this because they were a part of a trading route that they have uncovered. I wonder what life was like in Zoar that day as they looked out and saw all of their brother cities being destroyed. I wonder if they changed after watching that event. Zoar is only mentioned three more times in the Bible after that account. It's mentioned in Deuteronomy, then in Isaiah, and in Jeremiah. I wanted to quickly rehash that story because if you grew up in the church or if you came in later in life, that story of Sodom and Gomorrah isn't exactly the story that maybe you taught or that you heard as a young child. You heard kind of a summary of it. But as we saw, as we dug into the details of the story, we can take a step back and see that there's a lot more than maybe what we understood as a child. It's in the details that it unlocks another layer to the story. This morning, we're going to cover another very well-known story. It's a story of another miracle in which God intervened. Another story in which he stepped in and said, "That's enough." This one takes place in the New Testament. If you'd like to begin turning to John 11, we're going to read through the death of Lazarus. In reading through these verses, this message will be structured a little differently. We're going to move a little slower at times in some verses. Sometimes we'll reread verses we may have already read in the chapter. The story of Lazarus has a defining and direct impact on every one of us sitting in this room, and also those that join us on the webcast. Let's turn to John 11, verse 1 and 2. We'll read here. It says, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, in the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Martha who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick." Starts off right away with very discreet details of the individuals we're talking about here. It lets us know that these three individuals are family, Mary and Martha with their brother Lazarus. It identifies very specific details of these individuals so that we can tie them to other accounts that we read. In Luke 10 and verse 38, you don't have to turn there. We actually won't be doing a lot of turning today, but in Luke 10, 38, we see the account of Jesus having entered a certain village, and he stops by the house of the sisters, Mary and Martha. We see in John that we just read, 11 and verse 1, that certain village that he entered was the town of Bethany. It's in the story in Luke that Jesus corrects Martha, being very task-oriented, in that serving is not always the best option at hand. Gives us a little insight into her personality, her temperament. In a separate account in Matthew 26 and verse 6, or Mark 14 and verse 3, we're told that a woman came to him with a flask of very expensive oil and began to applying it to his feet. In both stories, we recount that Judas spoke up and said, "You're wasting precious oil." He simply wanted the money. That same account that was referenced here in chapter 11, verse 2, it's also spoken of in John chapter 12. Chapter 12 and verse 3, the same account, not only though, it doesn't say a woman, it says Mary did this. Martha and Lazarus are also present in that story in chapter 12. And once again, they're interrupted by Judas, who says, "You're wasting oil." Right away, we know exactly who we're talking about in chapter 11, the three individuals and characteristics about them. Let's keep reading here. Verse 3, it says, "Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he who you love is sick. And when Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but unto the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Here we see the sisters knew exactly where Jesus was located. They sent a messenger to him. This is going to come into play later on in the chapter, as we see. The sisters sent a letter to Jesus through a messenger that says, "We need your help. Lazarus is sick. He's feeble. He's dying." Upon learning this, Jesus makes a decision that this sickness is not going to be unto death. We're going to use this sickness. It's going to be an instrument to show the glory of God. Let's keep in mind as we move forward, because knowing this, everything that Jesus does from here is very intentional. The objective is to show the glory of God. He's going to be very purposeful in how he acts. The word love used in verse 3 when Martha and Mary are writing the letter is the word philia. It means affection. It means to show a sentimental feeling for him. The word that Jesus uses in verse 5 when it says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus," is not philia. It's agapao, which is the verb form of agape, meaning selfless, unconditional, a sacrificial love. Jesus has a much deeper love for these three people. He sees them as part of the spiritual body, as followers, even. He's willing to do whatever it takes for the better benefit of them in the bigger picture. Much like God expresses agape for his children, Jesus expresses that same love for these three. Agapao, he loved them. And we see in verse 6, "So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was." Not exactly the reaction you would expect for someone who says they love you. So Lazarus, who Jesus loved dearly, is sick. He's feeble. He's laying on his deathbed. And when he hears the news, he stays there for 2 days. He does nothing. It's not the reaction we anticipate from him. So remember, everything he's doing is very purposeful since verse 4 until the end of the story. Very intentional. It's all to show the glory of God. On that purpose, he stays a very specific amount of time, we're going to see, before acting. He loves these three individuals with a godly love. He's not so much concerned about the short-term sickness that Lazarus is facing and the agony that these two sisters are facing, as much as the long-term vision that he has planned for them. He's waiting 2 days before he does anything. Read 7 in verse 10 here. It says, "And then, after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. And the disciples said to him, Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you. Are you going there again? And Jesus answered, Are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." Jesus is responding here to his disciples, trying to encourage them, instructing them to be purposeful in their actions. Be careful to complete all the responsibilities you've been assigned. No matter what we face in this life, we're to do the right thing. We spend our lives acting on what is true and just, walking uprightly, that is aligned with God, and there's no doubt by anyone who sees where our motivation is. As for those, contrastly, who walk at night, those paths that may ebb and flow based on their audience, based on agendas that they may be surrounded by, influenced by others, these individuals are for sale. At that point in time, it's just a matter of what the price is. They have goals that they believe are more valuable than God's kingdom. They're not led by the light. With this, we're going to see that Jesus inspires the disciples to return with him back to Judea. Before they go, he needs to make sure they know exactly what they're doing. In verse 11, it says, "These things he said, and after that, he said to them, Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him. Then the disciples said, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well. However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought he was speaking of taking a rest and sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, "Lazarus is dead." There's a little bit of confusion here. This happens on a few occasions with the disciples. People say something, they say they understand, and then events happen, and then they understand what exactly he meant. Jesus is absolutely clear with him in verse 11 here. In verse 14, he's dead. He's not sleeping. He's doing this to show the glory of God, so he wants to make sure they know what they're going into. They don't want misunderstanding that he's just sleeping and he's going to wake up. He wants everybody on the same page. Lazarus is dead from this point on. So, in verse 15, it says, "And I'm glad for your sakes I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him." If he was there, maybe things play out a little differently. Maybe he would have healed him right there, which in and of itself could have been a miracle. But he's saying, "I'm glad for your sakes I wasn't there. I didn't manipulate this one at all. I couldn't have been involved in it. This is going to be different. It's going to be more significant. It's going to be something greater than you've seen me do in the past." This is not specific to the disciples' account, but Satan, throughout time, has always manipulated mankind to try and justify God's miracles. Even as far back as we can read in Exodus, was Moses and the Egyptians. Pharaoh had the magicians be able to duplicate many of the plagues that God had, explain them away through science, through even Satan's manipulation of his magicians. Many times it's justified based on coincidences, or archaeologists will claim it never happened at all, just to disprove the power of God. Again, here, Jesus is acting very purposeful. He's going to show 100%, be clear with the disciples, you're going to see and believe what is about to happen. There's no justification for what you're going to witness. Let's read in verse 16. It says, "Then Thomas, who's called the twin, and to his fellow disciples said, 'Let us go, that we may die with him.' So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been dead in the tomb for 4 days." So here, between verses 7, when he told the disciples, "Let's go to Judea," and verses 17, 4 days have passed. Roughly 4 days, I'll say. 4 days, and the reason I say roughly is because we don't know that Jesus died the day that he told the disciples. He could have died prior. He just said, "Lazarus is dead." He didn't say he died today. He could have died the day before while he was waiting. He could have died right after the messenger left. He wasn't dead when he got the message. He said he was sick. We also don't know if they left the day that Jesus told the disciples. They could have left the next day. We're not told. So roughly 4 days has passed from verses 7 to verse 17. So we come to verse 18. It says, "Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away. And many of the Jews had joined in the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary was sitting in the house." We're very familiar with Martha. I mentioned back in the account of Luke 10, Jesus describes her as being worried and troubled about many things. Martha is very task-driven. As soon as she hears Jesus is coming, she doesn't even wait for him to get there. She goes and meets him. She's out the door. I've mentioned in the past, I can relate to Martha. I'm very task-driven myself. I wonder about the things that are going through her head as she's going out to meet him. She's walking out to meet him. You get a sense in the following scriptures here that she feels he's just kind of moseying along. He's not really moving with a sense of urgency. He's not moving fast enough, so she's going to go meet him. And in verse 21, "Now Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.'" We know that not everything that took place back then is recorded in the Bible. However, we know that God records what's needed in the Bible to inspire the message, the story, and the tone of what it is. I don't know if this is Martha's opening line of how she was warming up the room as she approached him. I don't know if she waved to him. She gave him a hug. There was anything of greetings before this. But the first verse recorded when Martha walks up is, "Why are you late? Where were you? This is your fault for what happened," almost. So, it's not exactly a warm welcome. I wonder if he wasn't taken back a little bit. They had a good relationship. We read that Jesus cared for them very much. He considers them believers, followers even. We know that Martha was likely under a lot of stress. Her brother had just died with everything going on. And here, what God inspires to be recorded, she had expectations Jesus should have been there by now. Martha knew where he was. She sent the messenger to him. She knew how long it would take to get there when he got the message. She requested him to come help. They had been waiting several days for him to arrive, and he didn't show up. Her brother dies, and in her eyes, it could have been prevented. It's unclear as to how far Jesus was, or how far away Jesus was when the messenger came to him, because the news of with the news of Lazarus being feeble here. Turn back to chapter 10 in verse 40, one page. We're told where Jesus was. It says, "And he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was baptizing at first, and there he stayed." So as chapter 10 wraps up, it tells you where he was, where John was baptizing first. Hold your place there. We're going to come back to chapter 11. Let's go to John chapter 1. We'll read a few verses here in John chapter 1. Verse 25, it says, "And they asked him, saying, why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet?" They're speaking to John. "And John answered them, saying, I baptize with water, but there stands one among you whom you do not know. It is he who is coming after me, is preferred before me, whose sandal strap I am not worthy to loose. These things were done in Bethabara, beyond the Jordan, where John was baptizing." This is where they were located, in Bethabara. Scholars and archaeologists don't know where Bethabara is located. There's two different locations that they suspect it was. The first location, and I'm going to slaughter this name, is called Yardin. It's up by the Sea of Galilee. It's about 120 kilometers straight north of Jerusalem. At 120 kilometers, it'd take about 4 days to walk on foot. The second location is Al-Magtas. Again, probably slaughtered that one. Al-Magtas, which is approximately 40 kilometers east-northeast of Jerusalem. It's located out by Jericho, right by the Dead Sea. On foot, it would have taken under 2 days to travel there. They know this based on trading routes, based on archaeologists, towns that they've dug up. They're all about 15 to 18 miles apart. It's how far someone can walk at that point in time each day and have a place to stay, place to eat. So they know how long it takes to get from one place to another. Not going to go too far into timelines. I've found there's a few subjects that where you just completely lose the audience. If you do go too deep into it, science, people start to remember why they quit that one in high school or college. So when you go too deep into science, history, and timelines for that matter, if you go too deep into them, it gets very confusing. With that said, the first location, Yardin, even if Jesus would have left immediately, Lazarus would have been dead for 2 days. He would not have been able to be there realistically. Martha could not have had an expectation for him to arrive before he died. Most biblical scholars believe that Jesus and his disciples were in the southern location, about 40 kilometers from Jerusalem. This is the location that would have taken 2 days or less than 2 days to travel to Bethany. And Martha had an expectation he should have shown up there. She knows when the messenger left, and she knows how long it takes to get back. Had he have left immediately, he would have arrived essentially the day Lazarus died, if he died in verse 6 or verse 7, when he told us, "Let's go to Judea, Lazarus is dead." So let's keep reading in chapter 11. Verse 21, It says, "Now Martha said to Jesus, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now, I know whatever you ask of God, God will give you.' Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.' And Martha said to him, 'I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day.' And Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever believes and whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?' She said to him, 'Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world.' And when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary." So Martha and Jesus have a conversation here, going back and forth. She's very task-driven. She came out to meet him. They have a conversation, and off she goes. She has things to do. Looking at the way she responded to some of his questions in verses 23 and 24, Jesus said, "Your brother will rise again." And she answers him, "I know that he'll rise again in the last day." Well, that's not quite what he said. Looking at verses 25, it says, "I am the resurrection. I am the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he will live. Do you believe this?" in the end of 26. And she says, "Yes, I know you're the Christ. You're the Son of God who has come into the world." Not exactly what he was asking. He's asking, and immediately after this, she answers him and goes her way. It appears that she has this expectation that he should have been here, and it even seems as if though she's a little dismissive to the questions he's asking here. Let's keep reading in verse 28. "And when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, 'The teacher has come in calling for you.' As soon as she heard this, that she rose and came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into town, but he was in the place where Martha met him. Excuse me. Here we see in verse 28, that Jesus mentioned Mary to Martha. We didn't read anything about Jesus having mentioned Martha. So again, it wasn't recorded, but he must have said something about seeing Mary. Martha goes. Didn't have cell phones in that day, so had to pull her aside, somehow mention to her, "He's asking about you. You need to go see him." We see that when Mary goes out, he's still in the same place. He hasn't moved as when he's talking to Martha. He's not exactly in a rush to make his way deep into town. He's not walking right up to the front door to announce himself. Remember, he's in Judea again. So Mary finds him in the same location. He's trying to keep kind of a low profile even. So we pick it back up here with Mary now going to see Jesus. And the Jews, assuming she was going to the tomb, have followed her out to provide an audience for this next conversation that we'll read in verse 32. "Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would have not have died.'" She brought the same message that Martha did. And yet, it says she fell down at his feet. Remember, Mary's very relationship-driven. She's the one that spent time talking, connecting, instead of helping her sister. She's very people-driven. They tend to be more empathetic, more emotional, more feeling-driven. We didn't see that reaction. That wasn't the first thing recorded when Martha went out to meet Jesus in verses 20 and 21. She heard he was coming. She went out to meet him and immediately blame him for not arriving sooner. Verse 32, with Mary here, she falls down at his feet, still blaming him. However, there's a different emotional approach here. In verse 33, it says, "Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled." We're not told how long these conversations went on. First with Martha, and now Mary. It appears that he's making an effort not to progress too far into town at this point, and now Mary has brought the Jews to him. Jesus is growing a little frustrated. If you look up the word groaned here in verse 33, it says he snorted with anger, annoyance, sternly enjoined. He was troubled, means stirred, even agitated. Maybe it's not playing out the way he thought it would. Remember, he did this very purposeful. He arrived on the fourth day in order to show the power and glory of God. And now he finds himself being grilled by Martha, and Mary's now sobbing with the Jews around him. He's getting frustrated. Let's pick it up in verse 34. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." And some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Jesus at this point is, "Enough talking. Show me where you put him. Bring me to him." So they're walking, and we see that Jesus is weeping. Verses 36 and 37 are the only verses in which are recorded where the Jews that are following Mary are recorded as saying something. The funny thing is, verses 36 and 37 couldn't be further from the truth. That's their perception of why Jesus is crying. They think he misses his friend. Could not he have saved his friend? It's their interpretation of why he is sad. Well, as a side note, we don't know how sincere they were. They could have even been said it mockingly. If you read the words saying, we don't know that they were even being sincere at that point. But what we do know is they're completely wrong. If you remember back, Jesus intentionally waited for Lazarus to die. He knew he was dead. He didn't miss Lazarus. He's there to resurrect Lazarus. He's there to show the glory of God. He's not crying because he misses his friend. I strongly suspect, we don't know this for sure, that he's crying due to how things have gone with Martha and Mary, the conversations. And we'll see this as the chapter unfolds. Remember, he considers that both of them are followers, believers. And now they're pointing the finger at him. If you go back and reread the conversation with Martha, did she really understand what he was saying at the level he was expecting her to understand? We see he's frustrated and he's upset, and now the Jews are making their comments. Right after the Jews make their comments in verse 38, then Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone laid against it. In verse 39, Jesus said, "Take away the stone, Martha." And Martha said to him, Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of him who is dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." There's no doubt in her mind, he's absolutely dead. Jesus intentionally arrived on the fourth day to undoubtedly show the glory of God. This day and age in the United States, death's not something that's very common that we deal with on an everyday occurrence. Even going back 250 years in this country, death was something that was very real. People had to deal with. And more frequently, sometimes people were mistaken for dead. Looking at a few quotes throughout history, it says, "Have me decently buried, but do not let my body be put in a vault in less than 2 days after I'm dead." That was on the deathbed, George Washington said it in 1732. "All I desire for my own burial is not to be buried alive." It's Lord Chesterfield. When suffering from tuberculosis, his last words, "Swear to make them cut me open so that I won't be buried alive." Frederick Chopin. It's not a rare thing back then to be buried alive. In the mid-1700s, a French physician recorded more than 150 pages in a 10-year span of premature burials and mistaken deaths. It happened quite often. 150 pages in 10 years. In fact, today, there are illnesses that can leave individuals paralyzed. Could be mistaken for dead back then. Rigor mortis can set in the living, and sometimes it takes a while to set in after death. It's not always a telltale sign that someone has passed. Ancient times, misdiagnosing death was a very common thing. People recovered from all kinds of things. Drowning, from comas, asphyxiation, lightning strikes, tuberculosis, all of them that would leave the impression that the individual had passed, but they hadn't. In addition to this, for 3 days, there's a belief going around that for 3 days after a person dies, the soul would hover over the body, intending to re-enter it. This is how they would reason or explain if a person would wake up from a sickness, wake up from something, that the soul would re-enter the body. Without medical instruments, they simply didn't know if the person was dead. It just happened. So if something like that happened, they would explain the soul re-entered the body. And so, it would have a possibility of happening up to 3 days, for only 3 days. The belief goes on, for 3 days, the soul hovers over the body, intending to re-enter it. But as soon as the soul sees the body's appearance begin to change, it departs. After the first physical sign of actually being dead, well, there's no more chance that the soul can enter the body, is what they say. On the science side of this, we know this as the biological decomposition of putrefaction. This begins after 2 to 3 days of being dead. This stage, as it advances, is exactly what Martha is describing in verse 39. To be clear here, I want to make sure nobody takes away, I don't believe Mary and Martha believed in this at all. This is simply what some of the surrounding nations, of some of the nations and cultures, what they would subscribe to. It was a factor that they had to deal with. It could be used to rationalize what they were about to see, had they not waited till day 4. Jesus showed that there's no way Lazarus was buried alive. There's no way it could be explained through a false pagan belief or justified through simple clinical diagnosis. Let's pick it back up in verse 39, where Martha, the sister of him who is dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Martha's telling him, "What are you doing taking away the stone? He's gone. It's over. He's dead. There's no coming back. It's too late." In chapter 40, he says to her, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you had sent me." Jesus is reemphasizing here with Martha, "I told you before, I am the resurrection." He wanted to make sure there was no way that anyone could doubt what was about to take place that was less than a miracle through God. He wanted to make sure that she understood this and all those around her understood this. As a side note, in verse 41, this is the only location in which Lazarus is referred to without his name or his pronoun. It simply says, "the dead man." It says, "Then he took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying." It's very impersonal. In the King James Version, it's simply written, "Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead was laid." The name of Lazarus is not used here until verse 43 when he's resurrected back to life. It's almost as if to Jesus it was just a body, just an empty physical body. It wasn't Lazarus until he resurrected him back. In verse 43, when he resurrects him back to life and his spirit re-enters him, it's what makes him Lazarus again, and he gives him his name. So we see in verse 41 and 42, Jesus is praying to God very explicitly, very out loud, speaking so everyone around him can hear. "Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I say this, that you sent me." We know that Jesus was looking to avoid the Jews. He went to Judea, but he's kind of being very careful where he walks. He was staying in the same place, both where Mary and Martha approached him. I don't believe that he's necessarily saying this for their benefit, even though they're there. He's not working directly with them. He does have the disciples there with him. And remember back in 15, he said, I'm glad for your sakes I wasn't there, that you believe. We also know that he loves the three, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, as we read in verse 5. Everyone there will hear what he's saying. I wonder if he didn't look at a specific person after the prayer, though. He said it for maybe their benefit, whether it was a disciple, maybe it was Martha, saying, I'm telling you again, I'm pulling for you. Please understand what's happening here. He's saying this with intention to be heard. We know that he's working with them more than the others around. He wanted to drive home the point of what is about to happen. Verse 43, it says, Now, when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave cloths, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to him, Loose him and let him go. Mentioned in the beginning, I wonder what life was like in the city of Zoar when they witnessed what it is they did. Kind of wonder what life was like for Lazarus after this, when that happened to him. You know, for months and years, people wanted to talk to him. In fact, we see in John 12 and verse 9, it says people would come around just to see Lazarus. They heard what happened to him. One of the ironic things is this story is about Lazarus, and he probably knows the least of everything that happened that day. For him, he fell asleep, and he woke up in a very ill-fitting outfit, essentially, that he needed help out of. Like, he doesn't know any. People have to tell him what happened that day. He doesn't know. Almost every time I've heard this story, I've heard a message about this story. We read verse 44, he's resurrected, and they go home happily ever after. That's it. But it's not over. The story doesn't stop there. If we look at verse 45 here, the very next word is then. There's a sequence of events that continues here. The story is not over. Verse 45 says, Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone, if we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation. What happened to Lazarus spread very quickly. We see that some Jews converted to believers. It was undeniable. Dead for 4 days, there was no way to justify this. This was the glory of God. There's no getting around it. Jesus was the Son of God. His influence is growing so much that it's beginning to threaten the Pharisees' power, their political status. It's beginning to threaten what they care about most. In verse 49, and one of them, Caiaphas, being the high priest that year, said to them, You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for you, for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish. Now, this he did not say under his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. The resurrection of Lazarus is the straw that broke the camel's back. They couldn't deny it anymore. From then on, Jesus proceeds very carefully where he walks. You can read through the remainder of the chapter, where he appears, who he goes and talks to. The powers that be at the time, the Jewish political leaders, knew they had to kill him, and they had to do it quickly. If they didn't, they were going to lose their influence. They're going to lose their prestige. They'll lose their control. This is further seen in the years to come. Later on, The Jewish powers put out things, the traditional books, such as the Mishnah and the Talmud, in the decades to come. They actually elevate those even over the Torah that cover the traditions of the Jewish people. That since Jesus came to the world and said, we're not just working with the Israelites, with the Jews anymore, we're working with everybody. They said, well, no. What, we got to continue this control that we have, and they create other books that they now point to even today. Jesus knew this was the case from the beginning. He knew this would be the miracle that would get him crucified. Let's look back, John 11, and read verses 3 and 4 again. It shows that he knew this from the beginning, and he was purposeful in everything he did and said after this, knowing it was leading to the end. Verse 3, it says, therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. And when Jesus heard that, he said, this is the sickness, not unto death, but unto the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Jesus didn't walk around seeking glory. He never glorified himself. He always put the glory and the focus back on the Father. In John 8 and verse 50, if you want to write it down, he even tells the Jews, I do not seek my own glory. He spent in his entire life doing the exact opposite. He always pointed back to the Father. Jesus knew this time was going to be different. He knew this would be the event that pushed things over the edge. This would be the event that would lead to his crucifixion. This would be the miracle that would result in the Father glorifying him through the sacrifice and resurrection. He intentionally delayed coming to Bethany. He knew he didn't have much time remaining. He knew in these conversations this would be some of the last times he would interact with both Martha and Mary. He was pulling for them, and likely why he was frustrated in those conversations. He's trying to state and restate to them in messages that trying to leave them with, the messages he's trying to leave them with. He knew that this miracle would set off a chain reaction that ultimately would cost him his physical life. The resurrection of Lazarus, one man, to physical, is the event that set the wheels in motion, resulting in the death and resurrection of Jesus, one God, to the Spirit. We know this event, pictured in Passover, affords us the opportunity to be resurrected to the Spirit and the ability to enter the kingdom of God in the future.